So this is Second Canto, Chapter 4, Questions 31 to 33. The Pratigya, solemn statement of purpose of this chapter, entitled The Process of Creation, is expressed in this excerpt from Srila Prabhupada's purport to verse 6. Maharaj Parikit did not ask his spiritual master, Sukadeva Goswami, to narrate Lord Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. He wanted to hear first about the creation of the Lord. Sukadeva Goswami did not say that the king should hear about the direct transcendental pastimes of the Lord. The time was very short, and naturally Sukadeva Goswami could have gone directly to the 10th canto to make a shortcut of the whole thing, as generally done by the professional reciters. But neither the king nor the great speaker of Srimad Bhagavatam jumped up like the organizers of Bhagavatam. Both of them proceeded systematically, so that both future readers and hearers might take lessons from the example of the procedure of reciting Srimad Bhagavatam. Those who are in control of the external energy of the Lord, or, in other words, those who are in the material world, must first of all know how the external energy of the Lord is working under the direction of the Supreme Personality. Pan means you take the pan and you take the gold out, you pan it. Afterwards, one may try to enter into the activities of his internal energy.
Okay. Thank you. There's some very clever wording.
Clever wording, yeah.
Prabhupada. In the last sentence, he begins by saying, which is a kind of eyebrow raiser for a devotee, if you know our philosophy. He begins by saying, those who are in control of the external energy of the Lord.
Yeah, that was.
Or in other words, those who are in the material world. And then he says, must first of all know how the external energy of the Lord is working.
Yeah.
It's sort of like saying that. If you think you're in the control, you know, the control of material energy, then you don't know how it's working.
Yeah.
That's rather a subtle formulation. That's how I understood that.
Yeah, well, that would be... I'd also take it that you have the there's that further element of what Krishna says in the Gita about the living entities are maintaining the universe. Mm-hmm. So we always have that, you know, Krishna maintains the universe. But the only reason that the universe is manifest, it's not just pradhan, but is because the living entities want to interact with it. And so then they're the ones who, they control it in that the performance of their activities is what will, means the results of those will be how the material energy will then respond. So in one sense, you can say that the person who's responding is the controller, but at the same time there is the element that it's not. Like Krishna is the as the Vishai, he's the enjoyer, but at the same time he's responding to the Ashray. Mm. You know, so he's actually, they said Krishna's controlled by his devotees, because depending on how they approach him and serve him, he responds to that. So his actions all depend upon how his devotees act. But at the same time, he is the controller. So in the same way, the material energy, you know, she's running things, Shiva's there, but at the same time, as they're just responding to how the living entities want them to manifest themselves. You know.
Actually, that will be, we will come to that, we'll directly state that the material creation is actually proceeding from the marginal potency.
Oh.
Because of our desire.
Yeah, because of,
The Lord is in charge of it, but like Prabhupada used to, when this question would be, if it wasn't for the living entities, their desire, the Lord would have no purpose
in creation,
in generating this material world. So therefore, it's the same we were talking about yesterday, or the day before yesterday, about karma. So if you want to be the doer, then you have to accept the results. So in the same way, the jiva accepts the result of this creation. He's held responsible for it. There's that famous, rather well known, when now Satyananda Maharaj at that time, he was Bhakta Forsten. He went to from Germany, Hamburg, the first temple in Germany, to London. Prabhupada was there. And he was like a, you know, straight off the street Brandon Bhakta. But he felt he had to ask Prabhupada a question. And his question was, if Krishna loves us, something along that line, if Krishna loves us and is our well-wisher, then why did he create the material world? And Prabhupada very heavily said, he did not create the material world. And he pointed right at
him.
Satyananda, you did. And then all the devotees were bowing down. Oh, Lord Brahma.
That's funny. What's interesting is, like, it means technically, if you look at it, you have Krishna, and then you have Radharani, and Krishna's effulgent. So, naturally, when there's effulgence, when there's an object, when the effulgent falls on the object, behind the object there's a shadow. Right? So the shadow will be there anyway, but no one deals with the shadow. It's not part of your pastime.
Right?
But then you have living entities who are supposed to be in that pastime, but they somehow or another, instead of wanting to serve Radharani or her expansions, want to enjoy that. So then what will be is they'll be, you know, pleasantly distracted and escorted to the shadow. You know, it says you want to enjoy here, you know. And so then they'll make a thing out of the shadow, but it's only there because you have those who won't deal properly with the substance.
Reflection.
That's all the same kind of thing as you don't. Means even that if you're using reflection is just part of usage in the main. But when you want to misuse the substance, then you're given the reflection to play with. So in that way, then it's that's only because of us. Yeah, because internal potency isn't interested in external potency. External potency is interested in internal potency.
Right.
So we're the only idiots that are interested in external potency. Term used as you mentioned the other day. An idiot? Yeah. Oh, you were talking about idiom, not idiot.
Yeah,
both.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so here is being brought out, solemn statement. Maharaj is bringing out here that the chronological study of the philosophy is important. That you jump to the essence, that's nice, but unless you're prepared for that, how it will work. Let's say there's going to be a big meal, and so that's the actual purpose, that's the interest. But unless you've, you know, properly prepared yourself, you've taken your bath, you know, activities have been done, you know, so that for it generates appetite and those things, then there'll be no meaning actually to the lunch. Does that make sense? So, yeah. So you won't be able to get anything out of it anyway. So their point is that all these other elements, if they're understood, it will purify one, create the particular understanding or consciousness by which you can appreciate then the 10th canto. But their whole purpose is to discuss that, but there's preparation needed. You know, that's always, you know, it's, everything is has preparation, right? This is something that is means. For Krishna, there's no need of preparation because he is that. right? That's the point. But when you're dealing with the feminine element, then there always is preparation. There must be preliminaries, then there's the activity, then there's the conclusion. So we see at 10th canto is not the end. You also have 11th and 12th. Or in Gita you have the 12th chapter, but you have the first 11 chapters and then the last 6. So this is always how you deal with energy. So therefore, even though it's the main thing, there's time. You want to cook. You don't just... It means you couldn't do it without any preparation. It means you would have to have some vegetables in the kitchen. Otherwise, how do you cook? I mean, you could just pick up the basket, throw it in the pot, unwashed, unpeeled, you know, and pour some water, but you would still have to have a basket and have gotten vegetables into it. So you'd still even call that preliminary. But you'll wash the vegetables, cut them, then you'll cook. Right? Does that make sense? So, you know, then you'll take it out of the pot, put it into something nice, wash the cooking pots, then you have the this will always will be, for any activities, is a preliminary and a conclusion. So this is very important, because why one would have to point this out? Because real females understand this, real males understand this. But the problem is the living entity, which is female, which thinks it's masculine, is trying to cut the masculine profile, will ignore this point.
The smeary middle.
The smeary middle, yeah. Yeah. So then, kind of bewildered, tatasta shakti here, yeah, right. In the middle here. Then,
they always say, you know, black, white,
black,
gray in between.
The gray in between, yeah. So that's where it's there. Just like Robert said, someone who's pretending to be asleep, you can't wake up. You know? So in this way, then one has to point out actually how to deal with the Lord's energy. So there's preliminaries. So this preliminaries then is studying of the first 9 cantos. Then the 10th canto will actually have meaning. You'll get the full understanding, full experience, full result. Then, because you've purified yourself so you can hear the 10th, it will have its effect. But then for oneself, if needed, or for others who are then on the path of perfection, then the 11th and 12th cantos technically show how to refine that and use it to advantage. In other words, how the first 9 cantos are used to advantage, the 11th and 12th will tell you technically how it works. At the same time, how to technically apply the 10th canto in your life. Does that make sense? Yes, no? Like that. So that's the whole point, is without preliminaries, you won't get full effect from the activity. And without conclusion, then you don't actually aren't able to get the benefits from the activity. Does that make sense? If we just cook and then everybody walks out of the kitchen, how you'll get any benefit, right? So there has to be the concluding activities of taking the food stuff out of the cooking pots, putting it into the serving things, putting that where you're going to eat, making all the arrangements, then you can eat. Does that make sense? So you won't get the result without the conclusion. And the activity won't either happen or happen properly without the preliminaries. Right? So every action is like this. Does that make sense? Hmm? 4.2, Chapter 4, The Process of Creation, Adhyaya Prakashika, the chapter at a glance. The Bhagavatam now returns us to the talks between Sukadeva Goswami and Maharaj Parikit. The king requests his spiritual master explain how the Lord creates, maintains, and destroys the universes, and to clarify whether the Lord takes direct command of the modes of material nature or works with the modes through his expansions. E.g. means example.
Yeah, for example.
For example, the Purusha avatars. Maharaj Parikit points out all pastimes of the Lord are wonderful. One wonder is that they remain inconceivable despite the endeavors of so many great learned scholars to understand them. Another wonder is that the Lord remains one even as he assumes different means of directing his material nature, including expanding himself into multi-forms. Sukadeva Goswami begins his reply by offering 13 verses of praise to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thereafter, he informs the king that the answers to his questions are revealed by Brahmadev to his son Narad Muni. The details are given in the chapters that follow this one. Okay, so bringing out the element that the Lord is wonderful and whatever he does is wonderful. So that even means his material creation is wonderful if we see it in relationship to him. And that he is expanded into everything and everywhere in all different forms. That he himself still is one, even though he expands. So these are very special understandings. To see everything in relationship to the Lord, and to be able to see that same Supreme Personality, no matter which aspect of the creation one is observing or appreciating. Does that make sense? Yes? No? Oh, yes, and one more is that the thing of what Maharaj talked about before is that who's in control of the material energy? Does he directly control it, or does he do it through his expansions and other things like that? Chapter 4. Shloka Anusharanam. Summary study of the chapter's verses. In the previous chapter, Suta Goswami was requested to speak about further questions. Maharaj Parikit asked of Sukadeva Goswami. He begins by describing how Maharaj Parikit, the son of Uttara, fixed his consciousness on Krishna as he assimilated the words spoken by Sri Sukadeva Goswami in the first three chapters of this canto. So doing, the king was able to fully detach himself from the material world and all fruit of actions. After glorifying the purity of Sukadeva Goswami, Maharaj Parikit continued his inquiries. So that's verses 1 to 5. So what we see here is that by this questioning, he was able to detach himself from the material energy. Right? That's the important thing, because the living entity being energy is attached. There's no way we can get around that. We have to be attached to something. Right? And that something ultimately has to be attached to the source of energy. Right? Now, so what actually the problem is, that the problem is not actually the material world. Material world is itself, and it's just there, right? But the problem is our attachment to it instead of being attached to Krishna. So now we're attached to the material energy, which is one of his energies, which is attached then through Yoga Maya to Krishna's actual eternal associates, and then is attached to him. So we're still attached to Krishna, but in a negative way, that neither we develop that relationship with him, and neither does anybody else. So what we're trying to do is reattach ourselves to the Lord and his associates. So when we attach to his associates, then they're attached to the Lord. Then we have that proper relationship with Krishna. So the problem actually is not attachment. The problem is misguided attachment. Right? That's important to understand. In the beginning, we may get very much absorbed in detachment, which is good, because our detachment is connected with material energy. But we should not detach ourselves from those things that are useful in Krishna's service. Right? Prabhupada gives the example of the great yogi. When people come and offer money, then his hands just automatically go behind his back. He takes no money like that. But Prabhupada said, when they come with money, we step forward and take it, you know, because we'll use it for, it's Krishna's energy, we'll use it for Krishna. So we become, we're trying to become detached from the idea of using anything for ourselves. Right? Because we got here because we wanted to use the spiritual energy for ourselves. So we're distracted and given the material energy to seemingly use for ourselves. So, means, so you're trying to take the Lord's energy and connect it to him. That it's as we are connected, then everything else is connected. So then by that connection, then Krishna is pleased, because then it's a relationship between the living entity and Krishna. But because of our attachment, we misuse it, therefore we stress the element of detachment. So, but what we're trying to get to is not detachment from objects and from use of objects, which is generally how detachment is projected, because it's detachment from karma, right? But actually what we're trying to get at is detachment from the desire for the result. That's actually what we're trying to get at. But you start from the gross and you move to the subtle. That's why sometimes it doesn't seem, we're talking detachment, this and that, and we'll be, you know, it'll be looking in the way of, you know, detachment from sense gratification, this, that, and so many things. But at the same time, is then they'll be talking about engaging the objects of the senses in the Lord's service. Right? So then we get that difficulty that it seems like there's an overlapping definition here that can be defeated by logical argument, because it's not logical. But actually, it's a progress from the gross form of attachment to the gross form of detachment that will create the subtle form of detachment, that therefore we can get at the subtle form of attachment. Does that make sense? So detachment is that middle stage that we take it from the gross to the subtle. And then in that subtle stage, then is our attachment is to Krishna and his service, his devotees. Does this make sense? So it's a very useful tool, but it is no way as an end or an identity. Right? We're not, our identification is not that we are, detached. Right? Our identity is we are attached to Krishna. Right? So technically, if you take the amongst the Indian sadhus, of, you know, they have all their groupings. Our sampradaya will be classified within tyagis, because we're in the process of giving up material endeavor. But within tyagis, we're devotees.
Even Madhvacharya, you know, because we would expect, knowing that Gaudiya Vaishnavism is, you know, has a broader vision and more universal and all that. So we might expect, as you go back in the sampradaya, that this idea, or, you know, the idea of renunciation would be expressed more like you were saying. But actually, Madhvacharya writes in one of his commentaries that I remembered it from what you were saying, that the jiva is always bandhana, is always bound.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a question of whether it's bound to maya or to
Krishna.
Bound
to Krishna, that's a very good question.
Jiva bandhana is...
That's you're not going to get out of that one.
That's the state of the living entity, eternally.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So even Madhvacharya,
yeah, it brings that.
Yeah.
It's also interesting that you mentioned that, and that brings to mind Shankaracharya uses, his approach is different. He just kind of finesses this point. But his point is, first take sannyas, then we'll talk. Because technically, according to Shankaracharya, if you're not a sannyasi, you're actually you can't be an impersonalist. Because they may detach themselves, but they can't really attach themselves to Krishna. So unless you've taken up, their only thing is you detach yourself from material energy, therefore then you'll merge into the Brahman. But they're not, and they'll use the thing of detached activity, but actually it's still attached because they want the result, but because they define, if it's not for a material purpose, technically then it's what is it, akarma, or okarma, it's not karma. Does that make sense? So then it's not actually an attachment. That I'm attached to detachment and getting out of the material world is not actually an attachment, because it's transcendental. so therefore it's okay. But that's as far as they can get. They can only use those first three elements. So then, if the gross detachment's not there, they don't have anything to distract, because senses, you can distract the use of the senses by using it in something higher, but they're just going to negate it, so you can't do it. So their process technically can't actually be followed to success unless one is sannyas. But the devotees, because they have Krishna, and the activities of Krishna are so pleasing to the senses, that Govinda, therefore even the grihasthas can take part in this transcendental process and dynamically progress on the transcendental path. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yes? No?
It is along this line, since you brought up Shankaracharya, it's very illuminating to understand, you can really encapsulate the difference between Mayavadi philosophy and Vaishnava philosophy by understanding the point that according to the Mayavadi idea, consciousness is nirvikar. They have this term, nirvikar. It is unchangeable. So this is why, actually, even if they take sannyas, it's not going to work. Because, as Prabhupada writes in his books, they take sannyas and then they start addressing one another as Narayan, you know. Because the consequences of this idea that consciousness is not changed is that I must be God. You know, everything is one. All consciousness is actually the same transcendental entity, and that can never be changed. And well, then, yeah, okay, fine, but what about Maya? And that's where this is the strange thing about the history of Mayavadi philosophy, because you see this in the final purport of Brahma Samhita. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, he summarizes four kinds of Mayavadi, basic schools of Mayavadi philosophy. And there are actually many, 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 many more. So even though their basic principle is always one, they find out so much to argue about, so much to differentiate themselves, you know, trying to understand how everything can be one, because, and it's all goes back to this point, is that they do not accept that consciousness can be changed. So then what do you do with Maya? And then, so then there's someone who says, Maya doesn't actually exist at all. And then someone else says that, well, Maya is the energy of the jiva. And then someone else says, no, we have to maintain this point that everything's one, so everything's Maya. You know, that's like the Shaktas, you know.
Oh, okay, that's the Shakti side of this.
So everything's Maya. You know, everything's one, everything's Maya. You know, in that way they don't differentiate. Everything becomes material energy, but then they say it's really spiritual energy. You know, that's how Durga ends up being, you know, or Kali ends up
Kali
being
Krishna,
God, you know. So anyway, they go through all these mental contortions, simply because their philosophy doesn't allow them to admit that for the jiva, and is clearly stated in Bhagavatam and in Prabhupada's purport confirmed, that under Krishna's order consciousness changes. Mm-hmm. And this is another important thing. Ramanujacharya's philosophy is built up on that principle. It's called Vishishta Dvaita. So the Advaita is there, the oneness is there. And then there's this Vishishta, which comes from Visheshana, which means specific qualities of. So what are these qualities he's talking about? So if you're a Mayavadi, you'd say, oh, that must be the three gunas, the Triguna. And so then you're back with the same problem. You've got the Advaita, and then you've got this Visheshana, which, you know, is not really part of, but that's not Ramanuja's philosophy. Ramanuja's philosophy is that consciousness is the Visheshana, is the quality of the living entity and the Lord. And consciousness is, he uses this term, apataksiti, is the qualification of, but it is not different from. It's a quality of, but it's not a different quality. So in that way, he's coming very, very close to Beda Beda Tattva. And so the whole Ramanuja's philosophy unfolds from there. Immediately accepting that, yes, there is one spiritual energy, but that one spiritual energy has its own qualifications, its own different aspects, its own visheshana. Actually, visheshana means particularities. So therefore you can have this jiva and that jiva and that jiva, you know, so many particular jivas and particular qualities of Krishna and particular pastimes, etc., 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 and it's all transcendental. You see. And then the material energy is just, again, the chaya, shadow or reflection of that. So that's really an essential mistake, logical error, you know, which is really ironic because the Mayavadis pride themselves
in logic, yeah.
On logic, but actually it's so illogical that they're actually the real Dvaitists. Because they end up with these two things that they don't know how to put together, Brahman and Maya.
Yeah, by their definition,
you know?
They can.
Yeah, they, you know, it just, it never, you know, you know, it's because I thought that, because you said, actually, Maharaj was just citing Srila Prabhupada, that take sannyas first, and then we'll talk. But why take sannyas? You see, because that's also an upadhi. There's also duties in this body, in the material world. So that this is how in the Kali Yuga you get things like Rajneesh, you know. I mean, demons.
Yeah.
We won't bother with his own titles that he gave himself. We just say Rajneesh Ashura. That, you know, you can do anything and it's spiritual. That book you wrote, Sambhoga Se Samadhi, which means, you know, Samadhi through Sambhog, through sexual enjoyment, which is a total contradiction, but, you know, this is the way he makes everything one. You know, it's also said that, the big avatar around here, whom you had mentioned, when you talked about, you know, his hand withdrawn, that's the famous Garudhar Chatterjee.
Oh,
yeah. And he used to, for a time, you know, he, when he was coming to his realization, so he was going through all these different sadhanas and practices, including becoming a Muslim for some time.
Oh, okay.
And then also for some time,
very rounded,
he was doing a kind of yoga, in which in one hand he was keeping a nice moist lump of sandalwood paste, and then the other hand he was keeping a nice warm sticky lump of dog stool. And the idea was to come to, you know, complete indifference. You know, you've been talking about indifference, so
yeah.
This is, you know,
that was his method.
Their idea of indifference, and you have to come to the point of, there's no difference between sandalwood pulp and dog stool. So, you know, in the morning, someone could come with a flower and a dog stool on a plate and, you know, decorate your forehead with dog stool. And because you're indifferent, you just accept it. So fortunately,
his philosophy didn't get
our,
very,
you know,
far.
Vaishnava philosophies are, as Prabhupada says, they are the real Vedantists in the sense of Vedanta. The Mayavadis pride themselves on their you know, having philosophical teeth, dantha. Mm-hmm. But the Vaishnava acharyas have punched their teeth right out of their head, so they are Vedanta without any teeth. There's nothing. I mean, when you analyze their philosophy, it just falls apart like this. You know, a castle made of playing cards. You know, just touch it, and everything collapses. And the only way one could become enamored by such a philosophy is one has to be insanely desirous of being God, and that's the only way you can explain it. I remember meeting, when I was in the devotees, sometimes we'd meet these kinds of people. I mean, in the West, and they were literally, by taking drugs and also reading some Upanishad book or something, you know, they were literally crazy. You know, you couldn't discuss anything with them because they were crazy. They'd be intoxicated. Their brains weren't functioning right anyway, and that's just the suitable state for accepting my life. Therefore, here in India, as Prabhupada pointed out on one morning walk in Mumbai at Jufu, that actually he said the hippies Chaturbhai Patel got all angry, because Prabhupada said actually the whole hippie movement was invented in India. these sadhus who smoked chillum and all this. The Westerners just came and saw, and then they went back and imitated. But it was started here. And then this person, you know, he was nationalistic, so we got all insulted and went storming off. And, you know, then the next day they patched it up and things like that. But it's a fact. In order to be able to comprehend Mayavadi philosophy, to see sense in it, you have to be whacked out of your skull on something.
Okay, next verses. He wished to know from Sukadev the answer to three questions. 1. How does the Lord create the universes, which are inconceivable? That's in verse 6. 2. How does the Lord engage his energies and expansions in maintaining and destroying the universes? From verse 7. And 3. How does the Lord himself direct the modes of nature, or does he do this work through his expansions? King Parikshit expresses full faith that his Gurudev will clear up these doubts. Sudha Goswami now recounts the reply of Sukadev Goswami. Sukadev first fixes his remembrance upon the Lord. He then offers his respectful obeisances unto him, who accepts the three modes of material nature for the purpose of creating the material world, and who is the complete whole and the inconceivable Lord residing within all. Again and again, Sri Sukadev makes obeisances to the Lord and glorifying him as the one who awards success to great philosophers, performers of charity, and chanters of Vedic hymns due to their dedication to his service. The Lord is supremely powerful and supremely pure. Even low-class persons like Kirata, Huna, Andhra, etc. can be purified by taking shelter of his devotees. So that's where this verse is. Sukadev offers more obeisances and glorifications, humbly asking the Lord to be pleased with him. Interesting, he said, accepts the three modes of material nature for the purpose of creation. Because the spiritual world is created on Sat, Chit, and Ananda. So Sat means is eternal. Chit, full of knowledge, and then Ananda is always blissful in the interactions. But now to create the material energy, or expand the material energy, do the creation, then the material energy being the reflection of shadow is the exact opposite. So those opposite qualities are then taken for the creation. Just like Satchitananda is how you create the spiritual, but it's always there. But the material then is based off of ignorance, off of temporariness, and full of and misery. And so those three are the template for designing the material world. So, you know, I mean, just from our viewpoint, then it can't be that great, you know, because everything's made out of it. Just as in the spiritual world, everything is Satchitananda. In the material world, everything is full of ignorance, temporary, and full of difficulties. Like that.
Yeah, I'd like to just make one short mind-blowing point. In the famous verse is summarized here, even low-class persons like Kirata, Guna, Andra, etc. can be purified by taking shelter of his devotees. So, Jyotunanda, Linda Pulkasha. And Prabhupada explains these as being different fallen races, and he gives different examples, like the Hunas, the Huns, you know, he said they come from the region of Germany and Eastern Europe and Central Europe, where you've got Germans get called Huns, and Hungarians get called Huns.
Well, also you have the they're also the Mongols.
Yeah,
they call the Mongolia and stretch right across. Genghis G and company.
But yesterday, in doing my research, I discovered that originally, because these, you know, in time these, you know, like Prabhupada points out how, in one purport, how the family line of Kshatriyas became Brahmanas. So in time, the characteristics of a gotra or a family line or even a species can change according to acquired qualities in time. So originally, this Kirata is half man, half tiger, and it's the lower part that's the human part, and the upper part is the tiger part. So like from waist up it's tiger, and from waist down it's human. And it specifically says the women, the females of this, they're able to transform themselves into looking like very beautiful normal women so they can attract their next meal. And that's where you get all these, you know, then sometimes women are compared to tigresses, but if you consider this Kirata, you can see where all these analogies originate from.
Oh, okay.
So I suppose when they were originally created, they were like that. There was some kind of Kinara, you know.
Generally, I think all these different branches, because in the human form, this is just supposed to be Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. But by the improper mixes and stuff like that, then you end up with all these different branches and stuff like that. So it's probably, you have that element also where you're, you know, it'll be the consciousness that'll be there, but it'll be crossing of species and that aren't supposed to be mixed.
One thing for sure, you definitely see in the West, I know when I've given lectures in the West, I very often, you know, through the years, would make this point. And those devotees who do book distribution, who are out on the streets and who interact with the karmis, as soon as I would say this, they'd start shaking their heads and laughing. Yeah, you know, that's the way it is. You know, because actually, this was not my idea. It actually originally Prabhupada said it, but he said it a very long time ago. And when I first joined ISKCON, I used to hear these very old, there were a lot of devotees in the Boston Temple when I joined, because the BBT was there. It wasn't called the BBT, it was called ISKCON Press. So there were some original, from the original crop, you know, of matchless gifts were there, and so they had their reel-to-reel tapes, and so it was really nectar hearing these, you know, most ancient classes And so actually in one class Prabhupada made this point, and I, you know, it struck me and I never forgot it. And you can see so clearly this point that I'm just talking about, you know, half man, half tiger. But in the West, if you ever have the opportunity to see a person walking their dog, look at the person's face and look at the dog's face and see how similar they are. That's what Prabhupada pointed out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a person with a bulldog will look like a bulldog. A person with a German shepherd will look like a German shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually taking on, yeah, even in this human form, that mentality by association.
Yeah, yeah. Even it's interesting you mentioned that there's a, even on the Western thing, there's that kind of concept. There was the there's an animated cartoon called 101 Dalmatians.
Oh yeah.
And in it, in the, yeah, one of the opening scenes,
right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
His father was in that movie.
Oh.
His father was a big actor. Well, a semi-big actor.
Semi-schmo. So then, he in that, one of the opening scenes is they have all these different people walking their dogs, and the dog and the person look exactly the same.
Ah.
You know, you have like the Afghan, you know, because they have that long hair.
Yeah.
Long. So you have, you know, kind of like the French woman with the long nose and the beret on and the hair coming out. And everything was, they were all, they also matched them. So it's kind of a
it's exactly, and you can see the symmetry, you know. Why in the West, in India there's only one kind of dog. You know, why in the West they have all these different kind, you know, golden retrievers and dachshunds
and Saint Bernards.
And yeah, Saint Bernards and
Great
that,
Danes.
You said the Afghan, yeah, Great Danes and
Chihuahuas.
Oh, so many different
Chihuahuas,
yeah, kinds of dogs, and it's they all match up to people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's even there was even someone showed me some video. It was also showing this. You saw from the backside a man driving in a sports car with the top down, real nice sports car, and then sitting next to him, you see what appears to be a red-headed woman, you know, like, and then the car with the camera is coming up around. And it's only when you get right up next, then you see this is a golden retriever. Because they set it up that the dog turns its head, you know, like towards the driver as the car, you know, the side car is coming up. So you don't get it until, you know, you're right next, then suddenly the dog turns and looks full on into the camera and into the dog before you're thinking it was, you know, like a red-headed Irish chick or something.
Now they have also bred a cat which looks like a tiger. They call it Toyger. It's a new thing. It's for those who want to be like tigers, and they can buy it.
Yeah, Toyger means small, like a toy.
Well, there's also a new breed of cat called Bengal. Maybe that's auspicious.
Bengal. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They bred the. It actually looks like Murari's, you know, Emmanuel.
Uh-huh.
We call him Emmanuel Cat, a philosopher. His name is German philosopher Immanuel Kant. We call this cat Immanuel Cat. It's spelled with a K, just leaving the N off.
Yeah.
And he's just an ordinary village cat, but they have a special bred breed in the West and looks very similar.
Yeah, called a Bengal.
You know, it's very prestigious, you know, to get a Bengal cat.
Okay.
Maybe more people will start to chant Hare Krishna.
Yeah, it's the Bengali cat. Yeah.
Once more calling upon the Lord's mercy, Sukadev acknowledges that it is the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, who gives liberation. Simply by thinking of him while following the path of authorities, The devotee can see the absolute truth. Again praying that the Lord be pleased upon him, Sukadev Goswami submits that his Lord, who inspired Brahma with knowledge, kindly decorate his statements. He then offers obeisances to Srila Vyasadeva, the incarnation of Vasudeva and compiler of Vedic literatures. He tells Pariket Maharaj that the firstborn, Sri Brahmadev, answered the same questions as placed before him by his son Narada. So, means we're entangled in the material world. He's wondering how to best get himself out. What was one's duty? So it's been established to connect oneself to the Lord. So that means you have to get out of here. So now he's pointing out that it's the Lord that is the one that will deliver you from the material world. And we see that to be able to discuss this by remembering him, by chanting about him. So the ability to remember, the ability to chant, that comes from Krishna himself also. Then we see is that now these questions were also asked by Narada to Brahma. So that makes them very good questions. And that now, quoting those, he will answer. So that's always the appropriate way, is that you quote the stories and the directions given by the acharyas. You know, that's always considered the superior form of discussion. So now we're all set up, basically with this chapter, that this will be described very, very nicely. So, makes sense. So 4.2, questions 31 through 33 are asked by Maharaj Pariket of Sukadev Goswami. These questions are the answer to question 30, asked by Sutta by Shonaka. The question 30 is about the further questions of King Pariket, who makes inquiries nearly up to the very end of Srimad Bhagavatam. Thus the full answer to question 30 really spans all that the king asks of Sukadev in his final week on earth. Because he's asked, you know, okay, now he asked for this. Now what further did he ask? In other words, what he asked before was so nice, he wanted to hear more. So that means you already have someone who's intelligent and has already progressed on the path ahead of you. Then one would be inspired by continuing in the same path rather than separately in the court. So now it's being pointed out here that he'll ask questions already all the way to the end of the Bhagavatam. So basically, the whole rest of the Bhagavatam is an answer to question 30. But these are the next ones that are there, so you would take these as the immediate answer, but technically they're only the first ones. Question 31. I beg to know from you how the personality of Godhead, by his personal energies, creates these phenomenal universes as they are, which are inconceivable even to the demigods. So here, interesting point, he's begging to know, means he's, you know, desirous to know. It's not that he has to be told, right? This modern idea that I have my rights and I demand them, then isn't exactly the way things are, because demanding them means you're getting your rights outside of, or an exclusion of, the other's rights. Because if you have rights, everybody has rights. So now, since everybody has rights, what is the way that you interact with other persons so that your rights are accomplished and their rights are also maintained? Right? So Sukadev has the right to have this knowledge, since he studied it. And Pariket Maharaj, because he's inquisitive, therefore it's the inquisitive person who has the right to know. But the relationship between the one who has the right to know and the one who has the right, already has that knowledge, then is submissive inquiry. Right? Does that make sense? So he's begging to know. Right? He doesn't just walk in there and, yo, man, you know, like this. He inquires. Because that is the connection. That's very, very important. The Vedic literatures bring this out in the Sikshavali.
of the Taittiriya Upanishad. That's the Upanishad that where we get the five levels of consciousness: Anamoy, Pranamoy, Manamoy, Vijnanamoy, Anandamoy. And so that comes from the third part, the Bhrigu-vali. The second part, Anandavali, that's where we get the essential point of the Rasa-vai-saha, that Krishna is Rasa, God is Rasa. And so all other rasas are actually leading up to this. So in this one, what's being brought out is the element of the connection between two entities. Right? So it's just like you have the husband and the wife. So then the sandhi between the husband and the wife, which sandhi means it has to be part of both, right? The twilight is part day, part night. So the sandhi between the husband and wife is the child. Right? So that's the sandhi. So like this, then it goes through all so many elements of the material creation and shows the connection. And then there's a motive for that connection. Right? Why it would be there? So the desire for children is why then husband and wife have children. They will be connected. They will actually have this. So it's very, very nicely brought out that the first thing is understanding these relationships. So this element of that is what connects. So technically that also is the abhideya. It means you'll have a technical rule. The technical rule is submissive inquiry. But the application of that is your abhideya. Right? So then the sambandha and the prayojana become connected through abhideya. So here the speaker and the person in knowledge becomes connected through submissive inquiry. Why are you smiling?
Yeah, I'm thinking of something funny to say.
Means now or later?
I can say it now.
Okay.
It's just that you know, Maharaj is giving us this very nice, serious presentation of the abhideya of our process. But before, when you were talking about the sandhi between the husband and wife, his child, so I was remembering that in the Hebrew alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
You see, all the letters have numerical values.
Mm.
And that's how these rabbis work with them.
Oh, the Kabbalah.
So, yeah, so there's a Hebrew letter for male, for man, and a Hebrew letter for woman. And when you add up their numerical value, then you get the Hebrew letter for child. And then that is related in a way to the abhideya, and we say the essential process, because in Judaism their teaching is the foremost commandment. You know, of everything that's in the Bible, all the rules and regulations, number one is be fruitful and multiply.
Okay.
So this equation is most important.
Most important. Yeah. I thought you were going to say when you add male and female, the number you get was zero. I thought that's what you were going to say.
No, that wouldn't be Judaism. That would not be Judaism.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. No.
Might be Buddhism.
Buddhism. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
Judaism is where they have, you know, these families. I mean, yeah. They're traditional, like, you know. 15 kids.
Yeah, yeah, no, a lot of kids. It's interesting, just on the what you're saying, just side has, where you have the two things that connect and it makes another thing.
Yeah.
In the someone was explaining in the Chinese characters that the character for fight, you know, means a misunderstanding between two people, is two feminine characters under the same roof or house. Like that. And that's the one used for meaning, you know, disagreement and fight. Okay, so we'll end here. And we'll continue tomorrow with these questions. This chapter is going to go through quite quick, actually. At least this part.
Yeah, but the next chapter will be
very long, okay.
Because we'll go very deep into these questions.
Ah, okay.
So then,
and there's a point. There's a, just a last point that. Anyway, we'll talk about it next time. But I just wanted to say, because I'm remembering and don't, I might forget it tomorrow, that question 33 in this outline is not worded by Prabhupada as a question. Yet, the acharyas say that there are three questions asked here. So I consulted with Bhagish, and I put this note on question 33. So those of you who have study guides, what you read there is, I mean, I'm not a Sanskrit scholar, but this is bona fide.
Okay. So this will come up tomorrow. Today's Thursday, right?
I just wanted to make the point today in case I forget.
Forget it tomorrow.
Can remember to say.
No, because now we have this. We see this.
Because I do give it the bottom in smaller type. The way this question, this verse 33, could be read as a question.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
But probably didn't read it that way. So that's sort of my footnote.
Okay. Okay.
You know, but it is based on bona fide,
yeah. No. Sanskrit family. Okay. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhakta Brinda ki, Chainatai Gauru Premanandi. Yeah, no, they're totally into it. Main thing is just that it has to be seen as that. See, is that he's able to deal, because every teacher has what group of boys that they're able to deal with. Because the more we expand, the more there'll have to be different groups. So he can deal with this. But then, on certain things, then PT will have more difficulty with that. So then you might find in situations where Madhava is not going to be around. Then in those situations, then we make some adjustment. But whatever it is, then there's no problem. I don't know if they discuss that.
No, not necessarily tomorrow. It would be better on the weekend.
Because there'd be the time, like Preeti takes them out for a month or month and a half on the Parikrams. Madhava won't be there, so then that might be uncomfortable for him.
Either Saturday or Sunday, whatever.
Kind of thing. So if those considerations are made.
Yeah.
So that was all. Is that Preeti Guru was worried that wouldn't be part of the equation, so therefore he was not so favorable. You know what I'm saying? Because it sees, in the past, any kid could come to the school. But for some, it may take 2 years, 3 years, 5 years before they fully are able to take advantage of it. So in the past, we never worried about it because we knew they would get there eventually. So every kid will get there. But the problem has come is that the society is being oversensitive to kids being in the system and not necessarily respond well, then, you know, basically that's the whole development of your CBT. And then because of this, then so much problems come up. So we've had to, even though Prabhupada didn't really want the schools to be very careful who they took, you know, we've had to become, just because it's demanded of us by the superiors, because if somebody, basically the day we walk in, if they don't start acting like a pure devotee, then there's something wrong with us. You know, their years of, you know, whatever they were before, you know, in this life, what they were in previous lives, that has nothing to do with their previous habits that we're supposed to magically change in one day. But, this, you know, so that's kind of, does that make some sense?
Yeah. Thank you. Has any help from my side?
Yeah, no, that's enough. That's enough.